From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, could a joint Arab defense force be up to the task of destroying ISIS? The U.S. charges three men with conspiring to support Islamic State militants. Australian concern over Islamic State brides. And being careful what you share on social media.
I'm at the airport with my family. Oh, nobody's home, right?
It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi has raised the idea of creating a joint Arab defense force, particularly in view of recent events in neighboring Libya. In a recorded speech to the nation, the Egyptian leader said a unified Arab force is needed more than ever to address regional challenges. The Arab League has been considering a proposal to build a joint force for some time, but it faces an uncertain future, partly because regional powers often take opposing sides on regional issues. For example, with both the United Arab Emirates and Jordan supported the Egyptian airstrikes inside Libya, Qatar criticized the strikes. Qatar has been at odds with Egypt's military-backed government since it ousted President Mohamed Morsi in July 2013. VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawy asked Michael O'Hanlon, Director of Research at the Brookings Institution, if a joint Arab military force could do the job.
Well, I think there are advantages to a joint force. You have to avoid thinking it's going to be a trump card or a panacea. So when you say, could it do the job, it depends what the job is. But nonetheless, it obviously would reflect a certain political consensus if it ever were used, and that could be useful in and of itself. And then, of course, it could combine some assets and increase the available pool of forces for certain missions. And it might help embolden certain countries who might be nervous about acting on their own, because if they acted on their own, they might make themselves a target for ISIS. But if they act as part of a coalition, perhaps that helps them feel a little more courageous, or like they have a little more solidarity with others. And so it could help in that political sense as well. So I think it's not a bad idea, but, you know, we already have a lot of alliances around the world, and there's already the GCC in the Arabian Peninsula. And these alliances don't make all these kinds of operations easy or automatic. So you have to keep your enthusiasm in check.
So what could make such force a viable one?
Well, there really is nothing that you can do to make it a guarantee in any situation. I didn't say it was not viable. I said it depends on the job. And so if the job is modest and not overly controversial within the Arab world, and, you know, not overly demanding of available resources, then it could be done. So perhaps a limited bombing campaign against ISIS targets in Libya, or perhaps even helping stabilize certain parts of Libya, because it's not a very populated country, so you don't need a huge force to do that if you're just trying to protect a certain, you know, sector of the country. Those are the kinds of jobs that perhaps it could do. Maybe it could also attack Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula in Yemen. Those are the kinds of missions it might be able to do. What it can't do is turn around a war like Syria. It's just not going to have the capacity.
Was Sisi's call for a joint Arab force a genuine one, or just a reaction to UN Security Council rejection of his initial call to form a UN-backed force to deal with the Islamic State in Libya?
Oh, I don't know, but even if there is a broader UN resolution or effort on a given issue, it's often very useful to have a combination of a regional force. We see that, for example, quite a bit today in Africa, where quite often the African Union and also the United Nations are working together in various countries on missions that may be either overlapping or mutually reinforcing, or even co-branded as both an AU and a UN mission. And what it does is it involves the regional countries that care the most about an issue, but it allows them to act as a group, which can be good for the message it sends to the outside world, to their enemy, to each other. It helps them psychologically and politically. And so I think it's always useful to have regional groupings addressing regional problems when that's feasible. So I would not see this just as an alternative to the UN or as a second best option when the UN has failed. I would see this as a constructive approach, irrespective of whether the UN is involved.
The U.S. is not interested in putting boots on the ground. Would Sisi's call be a good opportunity to marry airstrikes to Arab boots on the ground?
Well, maybe. But again, I'm nervous about taking this idea and assuming it's going to solve the Syria situation for us, which is sort of what the implication was that I took from your question, because that's, of course, the place that we're talking most about, mm-hmm. where the United States does not have boots on the ground, and where Turkey is upset that none of us have a willingness to put boots on the ground. And so that's an example of where I would counsel against taking this sort of an idea and assuming that now we have a winning hand. I think it's going to take more than that to turn the Syria conflict around. The joint Arab force might be able to help, but it is not going to be adequate to the task.
Michael O'Hanlon, Director of Research at the Brookings Institution. President Barack Obama, at last week's White House summit on violent extremism, acknowledged the need to address the political grievances that drive people to terrorist acts. He said violent extremism is fueled when people are oppressed, dissent is silenced, and human rights denied. A new Atlantic Council report makes the same point, but it challenges the notion that the United States must choose between its immediate security interests and broader institutional reforms in the Arab world. The authors argue that extremism and instability are symptoms, and that the main drivers of the troubles in the Arab world are poor governance, failing economies, and political illegitimacy. They contend that to be successful, U.S. policy for the region must address these underlying issues that drive the political grievances. Co-author of the study, Faisal Itani, is a resident fellow at the Atlantic Council. He spoke with my colleague Mohammed El-Shenawy about the recommendations contained in his report.
Mr. Itani, in his remarks at the summit on countering violent extremism, President Obama said, "We must recognize that lasting stability and real security require democracy." Would that contradict your report's argument that the U.S. policies favor stability over reform in the Arab world?
Not quite. And I believe that's because there's a fundamental dilemma that the Obama administration faces, and it plays out in their policies. I do believe President Obama actually genuinely believes this to be the case, that these are the core requirements for stability. And they're rooted in good governance and democracy and other things he described. I also think, though, at the same time, this particular president and others before him have felt there actually isn't much the United States can do to advance that agenda. So you see a divergence between the rhetoric, some of which may be genuine, and the actual policy, which doesn't reflect or fall in line with that rhetoric.
Your report calls for a major shift in U.S. priorities to focus on the core elements of sustainable political and economic development in the region, arguing that extremism and instability are symptoms of poor governance, failing economies, and political illegitimacy. What are your recommendations?
Well, first, you know, there's two levels of crisis in the Middle East. There's a sort of slow-burning, insidious crises, and then there are the fires that are out of control in places like Iraq, Syria, and Libya. I think first we need to concentrate on the fires and limit the damage they're doing for the long-term prospects of stability in the Middle East. And that requires moving beyond a sort of short-term counter-terrorist approach that's very narrow and works with some questionable partners on the ground in places like Iraq, as well as the sort of hands-off approach we've taken towards Syria. In other places where we have amenable partners, the U.S. has plenty of tools. It has educational exchanges. It has business development tools. It has public and private diplomacy. And then there's finally the need to articulate and connect with civil society groups on the ground that are hoping to change the sort of the popular values of these sort of places, without which there cannot be a democratic shift and change.
So what tools could the United States use to prod Arab governments to advance pluralism, basic rights, and respect of human rights?
It requires a very broad approach. I believe it starts with orienting some aid and support towards private sector development, not just direct budgetary support, giving technical assistance to institutional reforms that improve the private sector, improve the investment climate, aiding security forces to operate in a transparent, disciplined manner, facilitating trade and investment between the United States, and also, I think most importantly, not seeing terrorism, the problem of terrorism, through a very narrow prism to be addressed with things like drone strikes and assassinations. We need to be much more ambitious than that. We need to be able to build local partnerships. We need to be able to understand how to create polities and societies in which the grievances that fuel things like Sunni and Shia jihadism can be addressed.
Final question. President Obama emphasized the need to deal with the economic grievances in the Arab world that terrorists exploit. How could the U.S. help in promoting sustainable economic development in the Arab world as a tool to fight extremism?
Our report mentions very specifically the issues of technical private sector assistance, educational exchanges, etc. But there's also politics wrapped up in this economic problem. I mean, a lot of these regimes, particularly insecure regimes that are heavily repressive or heavily paranoid, don't frankly have much appetite to take the kinds of risks potentially economically destabilizing that would open up economies and create jobs. A lot of these are obviously very elite-dominated economies that in which, unless you belong to a tight circle of access, you're not going to have much economic opportunity. So this starts, to be honest with you, with political and institutional and legal reform, not just pure economics.
Faisal Itani, a resident fellow at the Atlantic Council. The United States has charged three men with conspiring to support Islamic State militants in Syria and wage war against the United States. Charges against two Uzbeks and one Kazakh were filed in federal court in New York Wednesday. New York City Police Commissioner William Bratton.
Two of the individuals were seeking to fly to Syria. One was arrested at the international airport, JFK International Airport, as he was getting ready to board that flight. A second individual had a later flight scheduled. He was arrested at home here in Brooklyn. A third individual who we believe helped to organize and finance the trip of the other two individuals was arrested in Jacksonville, Florida.
All three men resided in Brooklyn and were legal U.S. residents. Officials say they came to the attention of law enforcement based on statements they posted on social media. Australian officials are increasingly concerned about young women supporting radical Islamic groups. Ministers warn that some citizens have traveled to Syria and Iraq to become so-called jihadi brides. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Canberra believes there are between 30 and 40 Australian women who've taken part in terror attacks or are supporting the Islamic State terror network. While some are providing active backing at home, others have travelled to the Middle East. Australian Foreign Minister Julie Bishop has told Parliament that an increasing number of Australian women were heading to Iraq or Syria to join husbands fighting with Islamic State or to marry a militant. She's warned potential Islamic State recruits, however, that the group's attitudes towards women were utterly appalling and said if they travelled to the Middle East, it will be no romantic adventure. She warned that foreign women had ended up as sex slaves and, in some cases, suicide bombers. Homegrown extremism has become a growing concern for Australia's security agencies, and officials fear what might happen if radicalised women return home. About 90 young Australian men are thought to be fighting with Islamic State in Syria and Iraq. Bishop told MPs that females accounted for nearly 20% of all foreign jihadis in Syria and Iraq, and said the number of Australians joining their ranks was a worrying sign.
There is this phenomena of jihadi bride, and this means that young women are either attracted to a male foreign terrorist fighter, they are going with their male partner to Syria and Iraq, or in some instances they're actually looking for a partner and are being told online that there are opportunities for them in Syria and Iraq. Others are just supporting a terrorist organisation because they've been radicalised, either through a group or online.
Meanwhile, it's reported that an Australian man fighting with Kurdish militants against Islamic State has been killed in northern Syria. On Monday, Prime Minister Tony Abbott announced new counter-terrorism laws to tighten citizenship and immigration regulations, along with a crackdown on groups inciting religious or racial hatred. Last September, Canberra raised its domestic terror threat level from medium to high. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
The internet and social media are fantastic tools, but sometimes they are used for character assassination. Bullying can ruin a person's reputation, lead to permanent mental scars, and even lead to suicide by some picked-on youth. Blair London, author of Lure to Death, The Social Media Serial Killer, spoke with us about cyberbullying.
social media is it helps people connect with other people. A lot of times you can find a long-lost friend, but you have to be aware that sometimes people pretend that they're people that they're not. You know, sometimes you're corresponding with somebody you don't know. This person could be sitting in jail. They could be lying about what he or she posts. You know, similar to the dating sites, they always lie. No.
Well, could you give us some examples of cyberbullying between young people, say students?
A student can put something on social media complaining about somebody. I recently saw a post by a young single girl negating the rumor that she was pregnant. And then she went on to add a few colorful words about the people whom she thought started the rumor. So this started something. And, you know, not realizing, I suppose, that she's really harming these people and also hurting her own chances of future employment. And, you know, also she's targeting her colorful words toward someone who may try to get even. And she's opening herself up to be prey for other people because she's venting, and then some maybe person of the opposite sex or something might think, oh, well, you know, this is somebody that I can get to assist in some crime because she's easily angered, which could indicate a want for revenge, or to use her to satisfy his own sexual desire.
It's a very dangerous thing in reality.
Yes, it is. And I think one should be very careful what they put on social media. And I'm sure we've all heard, you know, in any circle of friends, you have one friend that's constantly on there and it's like, oh, they need a life. You know, you shouldn't post everything. You know, I even have a brother who posts things like he lives in another state. And when he's traveling, he says, I'm at the airport with my family. Oh, nobody's home, right?
Right. You can give away too much. Well, what should you do if your child is under a cyber attack by his friends?
Well, I think you should try to get to the source of it, perhaps confront the source, especially if it's by another friend, you know, some underage individual. That would be easier to confront the source, I think, than if it's somebody from further away or somebody that's older, somebody you don't know, because you can always go to the school, to the parents of that child. But I think that parents should monitor what their children put on social media.
Well, sometimes parents just don't know that cyberbullying is going on. Are there any signs if your child acts a certain way that might be a hint that he is being bullied?
Well, if they're unhappy or they don't want to participate in things, I think a friend of mine put this, you know, well, it's like if your child doesn't, you know, is too pressured by peers, it can be dangerous. And if they don't have any friends, it can be dangerous. You know, they're opening themselves up for that. And when their self-esteem is shot, you know, you need teenagers, they are always, and it starts before that too, but their self-esteem is so low. And you need to pump up their self-esteem so they don't look for this elsewhere.
Well, tell us a little bit about your book.
It's about a character, his name is Sandy Bean, and he was labeled as the string bean in high school, and he was bullied by fellow classmates. And he's on to discovering something ingenious that can make him millions, but his classmates destroyed the lab that he was working on this experiment. And so then he tries this at home, but something goes wrong, a fire occurs, his parents die, and so he blames this on his classmates. And then the reunion is coming up, so he plots to get revenge, and through social media and all types of viral marketing, he lures these classmates to supposed events before the reunion and lures them to their death.
Well, I don't want you to give away too much.
No. But Lure to Death, the Social Media Serial Killer, is available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble.
Author Blair London. Well, thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. And you can also re-listen to this program if you like to. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On February 26, 1815, former French Emperor Napoleon Bonaparte escaped from the island of Elba, where he had been exiled after being dethroned. With a dream of reestablishing himself as head of a French empire, Napoleon was briefly able to regain control of France before the monarchy was restored. In 1901, the two main leaders of the Boxer Rebellion in China were beheaded. The so-called Boxers led a violent anti-foreign and anti-Christian movement in China between 1899 and 1901. On this day in 1919, President Woodrow Wilson signed into law an act of Congress establishing the Grand Canyon as a national park. On this day in 1929, President Calvin Coolidge established the Grand Teton National Park. In 1936, German leader Adolf Hitler opened an assembly plant for the manufacture of a new automobile designed for the masses, the Volkswagen. In 1980, Egypt and Israel established full diplomatic relations. On this day in 1984, the last U.S. Marines sent to Lebanon as part of a multinational peacekeeping force left Beirut after a violence-plagued 18-month mission in which 265 Marines lost their lives. On this day in 1993, a bomb exploded in the parking garage underneath the World Trade Center in New York City. Six people died and more than 1,000 people were injured by the powerful blast apparently aimed at toppling one of the Trade Center's twin towers. Six Islamist extremists were eventually convicted and sentenced to prison for their roles in the bombing. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Members of the Assyrian Christian community in northeastern Syria say as many as 200 people might have been seized in raids on a string of villages near Tal Tamer in Hasaka province. The captives include women, children, priests, and the elderly. Hundreds of other civilians remain trapped in villages surrounded by ISIL fighters, and clashes continue between ISIL and local forces defending their communities. ISIL burned and destroyed homes and churches, and the violence has reportedly displaced more than 3,000 people. The United States demands the immediate and unconditional release of the civilians taken captive and all of those held by ISIL. ISIL's latest targeting of Christians is only further testament to its brutal and inhumane treatment of all those who disagree with its beliefs. ISIL continues to exact its evil on innocents of all faiths, and the majority of its victims have been Muslims. People of all faiths and many religious leaders throughout the region have united in condemning ISIL's barbarism, including its mass killings, rape, sexual enslavement, lashing, stoning, crucifixion, torture, and public murders of hostages. ISIL has forced Christians living in its territory to either convert to Islam, pay a religious levy, or face death. Sadly, the Syrian people are threatened not only by ISIL's brutality, but also by Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's unrelenting campaign of terror. The regime has recently intensified its airstrikes and barrel bombing of Aleppo and continues to besiege the Damascus suburbs of eastern Ghouta and Douma, cutting off humanitarian aid from those in need. The United Nations Commission of Inquiry reaffirmed the deteriorating situation, noting in its latest report that the Syrian people continue to suffer from the Assad regime's airstrikes, barrel bombings, arbitrary detention, torture, sexual violence, and murder. Like ISIL, the Assad regime is showing its complete disregard for human life through these crimes. In an effort to bring an end to these horrors, the United States remains committed to leading the international coalition to defeat ISIL and to work towards a negotiated political solution that stops the bloodshed and secures a future of freedom, justice, and dignity for all Syrians.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at voanews.com/editorials.
Daddy Washington. Hello, in Irvine.